This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, bringing you coverage of the first debate between the two candidates for the Democratic nomination for the 5th Congressional District of Virginia. This debate between Al Weed and Bern Ewert is moderated by former Assistant U.S. Attorney Tim Hafey at a Democratic breakfast in Charlottesville on January 21, 2006.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Tim Hafey, and my job today is to moderate this discussion, what I expect to be an elevated discussion between our two strong candidates to challenge Virgil Goode in November. I want to start out by just sort of explaining to everybody what the format is going to be. Each of the candidates will be given 5 minutes to give you an overall sense of who they are and why they're running. We're then going to go into a series of prepared questions that I have come up with, a couple that are for both candidates and one each for them specifically based on some things that they have already articulated. That'll only take a few minutes. Then we get into your portion of the program, and that's the opportunity for you to ask questions. If we have time after the written questions, Al and Bern will have a chance to ask each other a question or two. And then at the very end, if we, again, time permitted, we'll have an opportunity for some of you to raise your hand and ask some questions from the floor. There are so many of us here that, again, I'm going to try my best to make sure everybody gets equal time, that everybody has an opportunity to speak who'd like to do that. We'll probably take somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 minutes or so for this whole process to run its course. With that, I think we should go right to opening statements. Given that Al is seated over farther from me and has done this before, maybe we'll ask him to go first. Al, if you could give us your 5 minutes on why you want to tackle this again. And when you're finished, we'll ask Bern to do the same. Thank you.
Sure, Tim. Good morning, Democrats.
Good morning.
I'm Al Weed, and I was your candidate last time around. That may not give me the right to run again this year, but it surely gives me the right to ask. Like most of you, I have a family, a wife of 39 years, a son serving on active duty in the U.S. Army as a physician, and a daughter teaching here in Elmhall Schools. And like most of you, I'm angry at the way conservatives have distorted family values to include hate and bigotry. Like most of you, I've had the opportunity for a higher education. I have degrees from Yale and Princeton. And like most of you, I'm angry at the way this administration has distorted science to support their right-wing agenda and ignore the threats of global warming at the world's peril. Like most of you, I have been active in my party and in my community. I have started or led over a dozen organizations in the 33 years I have lived here. And like all of you, I am angry at the way Republicans ignore community as they slurp at the trough of tax cuts for the very wealthy and ask the least among us to bear the price. Like many of you, I serve my country in uniform. Over 42 years of service, mostly in airborne special operations. And like most of you, I'm angry about the war in Iraq that is killing Americans and Iraqis in pursuit of the chimera of an imposed Western-style democracy. Like most of you, I have worked all of my life to make a living for my family. I'm one of the founders of Virginia's wine industry and have worked with my hands, hearts, and mind to make this a thriving industry that it is today. And like all of you, I am angry at the way the Bush policies are destroying the middle class, widening the income gap, and giving too many children the bitter Hobson's choice of going in debt if they can afford college at all, or enlisting in the military to fight in a bogus war. Yet for all of that anger, it is a luxury to many in the 5th District, and a luxury many cannot afford. In Southside, where I've spent most of my time since the beginning of the year, and where I spent a great deal of time the last time campaigning, headlines are very different. Here, perhaps, the war, a dispute over zoning, or some other relatively local, not so bad problem. There, yet another local plant closing, another announcement of job losses, another drug-related killing, another school funding issue. Occasionally, to be sure, a few new jobs are added, usually at $8 an hour with some benefits. And this brings the banner headlines reserved in this community for a Virginia ACC upset win. These economic troubles have brought to the surface deep divisions of race and gender that for a century were suppressed by steady, albeit low skill and low paid work. Southside must face his history at the worst possible time. Still, there are people working hard for progress, reconciliation, and justice. People of both races and all income levels who love their home and sorrow at the loss of confidence and self-esteem in their community. This, I believe, must be my task as your congressman, to bring every energy I can to help Southside build a new future. Sure, you know if you send me to Washington, you will have a congressman who doesn't embarrass you, who votes mostly, I suspect, the way you want me to on national issues, and who responds to your needs. But know also that I will call on you in this prosperous part of our lovely Commonwealth to help our brothers and sisters facing a severely changed world. On Tuesday, driving through the furniture areas of Bassett and Stanleytown in Henry County, places where plants still operate, yet at a much lower employment level, I was struck by the contrast. On one side, you have operating plants, jobs still being held, and on the other side of the same road, houses and businesses boarded up, closed down, and it struck me that the only difference between many parts of our 5th District and the Gulf Coast was that the boarded buildings weren't rotting inside from floodwaters. Yet the flood of globalization has affected people in Southside very nearly as badly as it has affected people on the Gulf Coast. Ironically, the next morning, the Danville Register B reported that Danville is the 5th slowest growing metropolitan region in America. 3 of the 4 ahead of Danville in this ranking were regions on the Gulf Coast that had been swamped by Katrina and Rita, I guess. We must all share in the burden somehow of helping our fellow Virginians in Southside. Let us show America how Democrats understand the meaning of community and love for our fellow man. With your support, I will help lead this effort. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Burton Ewart. It's good to be here to see you. I'm running for Congress because, like you, I'm very concerned about the future of our country and the undermining of the foundation of our nation. We just had 2 grandchildren born a year ago, and when I look at the debt, the $1 trillion that George Bush has added to their shoulders, and to the $1.5 trillion that Virgil Goode and George Bush have raided out of Social Security, I decided that I couldn't just stand by and watch, that I at least had to add my voice to the effort to change the way we do things in Washington. I'm appalled at the destruction of our reputation worldwide. I've worked internationally. I have friends in the Czech Republic. We've lost our position of moral leadership in the world. It's the first time in my life that we're not seen as the moral leaders of the world. And people now look at us and ask, who are you? What's happened to you? What are you going to do to change what's going on in America? I'm also tired of the sloganeering and the empty promises that come from Bush, Karl Rove and his crowd, and Virgil Goode. Empty sloganeering words, they're not real solutions. They're not solutions that help people in their daily lives and help people have better lives, the kind of lives that each one of us want to have. So what does the 5th need? Al's exactly right. They need jobs. And they need jobs today. They need to have a stronger middle class, and that means affordable health care, a decent price for gasoline and transportation, Medicaid, the bomb of Medicaid that's coming our way that we're not even talking about, and the debt that is being piled on our children and our grandchildren by an irresponsible administration and a compliant Congress. Yes, they want us to regain our position of moral leadership in Southside and throughout the district, and they want us to rebuild our military so that we can fight terrorism here and abroad. So why can I win? Why am I here to talk to you about this? I lived in Roanoke for 16 and a half years. I was in public life for 13 and a half years. I was on television. Roanoke is the media center. Over those 13 and a half years, I was on television throughout Southside down to North Carolina 3,000 times, talking about what we were doing to rebuild Roanoke. And what did I find in Roanoke in 1978 when I became city manager? I was 35 years old. I'd been hired. I'd spent 5.5 years here as deputy city manager. We had a city council that had been elected by a coalition of business people, neighborhood people, politicians, Republicans, Democrats, independents. It was a community that wanted to change. They had the second highest tax rate in Virginia. They wanted to rebuild their downtown. They wanted to cut the real estate rate from $1.60 to down below $1.30 where we took it. They wanted to rebuild their neighborhoods. They wanted to integrate the city government workforce, which is what I did here when I was deputy city manager, and what we did there. And they wanted jobs. Roanoke had been crippled by the loss of steam engine, and it went to diesel, and they had a very large factory closed down. They lost 10,000 jobs, just like that. Well, in that period of time there, and I'm the only candidate in this race, Republican or Democrat, who can say this, in that 7.5 years in Roanoke, we attracted 5,000 jobs to the city of Roanoke. And when I was county executive of Prince William County from 1997 to 2000, starting literally at zero, we attracted 3,500 high-tech jobs and over $600 million in investment. I know the business of economic development, job attraction and creation, and what that region must do to make that happen. It's not a theory for me. It's something that I worked at very hard and diligently my entire time in Roanoke. The people want solutions. They want real solutions for their neighborhoods and towns, for their downtowns, and for the rural area and for a clean environment. They don't just want more talk. They're looking for a person who can bring the region together and has a record of bringing a region together. A record of bringing a region together as we did in Roanoke. Roanoke populated by people who grew up in Southside and Southwest and West Virginia. So I want to ask for your support and let you know that I have a record of success and that I will work as hard as I possibly can to change the situation there and to bring leadership to Congress that you'll be proud of. Thank you very much.
All right. Good start. Thanks both very much. All right. The next portion of the program is my favorite because I get a chance to ask you some questions that I've came up with after looking at some of the things that both of you have said, some of the press coverage of your campaigns, some of the things on your website. I want to start out with what I think has got to be the most significant issue in this district, and that is the economy and jobs. It's unquestionably true that we're hemorrhaging jobs, particularly in Southside. Plant closings have been a major problem over the last several years. Jobs are being exported overseas. I got double-digit unemployment in some of the communities in this district. I want to ask each of you if you have specific plans to revitalize the economies in those distressed areas. How do you plan in Congress to replace those manufacturing jobs that have unfortunately left our district? Let's start with Byrne, since Al started with the opening statement. You have 2 minutes, Byrne.
We don't have a national manufacturing policy in the United States, and we need to have one. It needs to be broad-ranging, and we can start with affordable health care, which is pulling General Motors and other employers down. General Motors obviously has more problems than that. They need a regional marketing agency in Southside, Virginia, and this is the first time that this has been proposed in this campaign. Danville, Martinsville, Halifax, Henry, Mecklenburg, and Pennsylvania County. You know, it's not fancy, but they need to get together. They need to be spending $2 million a year to market and bring industry into their region. That's how we did it in Roanoke, and that's how it's done. You have to bring in enough prospects. You have to have industrial parks and property and the right tax rates and incentives, and you have to be a partner with the state of Virginia and the Virginia Economic Development Partnership, and you have to know how to do that. And that, for me, would be the major thrust of what to do in Southside Virginia. It will take time, but it's something that we could start on next month. There's an opening for a director for the Henry County Martinsville Economic Development person. If they could combine them together, I believe they could make a lot of progress, and I would work towards helping them get new money for that undertaking.
Well, there's no question that they need jobs, and they need jobs right now. I've talked to people who are taking Trade Act assistance and going back to school at age 55, not because they expect to learn anything they can do anything with, but they'll get 3 years of unemployment insurance while they're doing that. But people in Southside have also awakened to the fact that for a century their future or their prosperity was based on low-skill, low-wage jobs. And those jobs no longer exist in America, and to the extent that they do exist and you see new jobs being created in these regions, they are just there to exploit that low-wage base until they get a lower wage in India or China or someplace else. People there realize that for centuries, or a century at least, it has been almost public policy to keep wages down, and therefore to keep skills down. And they know that the answer to their economic future is a much better education system and a much stronger commitment toward raising the skill level of every person there, black or white, in every school in that community. And they, I believe, are committed to making the long-term investments that will give them that future. And that's where a congressman has the best role. You see what happens when a congressman goes out and tries to get jobs for his immediate district. Immediately, he ends up getting $90,000 in illegal campaign contributions. I don't think that's the role. Never to say you wouldn't facilitate anyone wanting to move into the district and create jobs. But I believe it's the job of a congressman to know what people want, to know what their aspirations are, to know what their hopes are, and to work for a better future for their children and our children.
All right, Al, thanks. I know that both of you want to spend most of our time this morning talking about your own vision for how you would help solve the problems of this district, but we got to spend just a minute on Congressman Goode. And I want to pick up briefly, Al, on something that you just said with respect to campaign contributions. Congressman Goode, as has been written recently, has inserted some specific items into defense spending bills on behalf of this MZM corporation. He often did so within days of receiving significant campaign contributions from MZM. You have both called on Congressman Goode to return the $90,000, approximately $90,000 that he received from MZM. I think everybody would agree that that's a good idea. But I want to ask you if you could go a step farther and talk for a little bit about thoughts you might have on lobby reform, on some of the proposals that have been put forth recently in Congress to change the way money influences politics. Do you have specific thoughts about not just Congressman Goode's situation, but generally whether or not there needs to be a different way of doing business with respect to lobbying in Washington? Let's start with Byrne now for 2 minutes and then out.
Oh, okay. Well, the National Democrats have a plan which they proposed, which I endorse. I believe Al has endorsed. There are several problems that we face. One is the earmark. It's an earmark is what he did. There are those, and I would be one, who would call for the elimination of earmarks, not to allow them. But secondly, if they're going to allow them, to have two votes on any piece of legislation. The first vote on the legislation itself, and then in the light of day, the second vote on the earmarks. I think we'd see a lot fewer earmarks in Congress. Now, I've been in public life, and I've had people try to influence me. I never let people buy meals for me, pay for trips, or any of the rest of it. Congress, on the other hand, you know what they do. You know what they allow their staff to do, and I would never allow it. It's a work in progress up there, but a lot has to be changed if the government is going to be changed. And the Wall Street Journal has suggested And there are many suggestions, and I think we would all agree on most of them. But I like this one that the Wall Street Journal proposed, which is that on those key money committees and appropriation committees, that you only be allowed to sit on that committee for a total of 6 years, so it doesn't become a fiefdom of some particular congressperson, be they Republican or Democrat.
If I sit here, can you hear me? That saves time moving back and forth to the lectern. Burns, right? I signed on to the new ethics. You need me to stand up. Fair enough. Burns, right? I signed on to the new ethics thing that the Democrats have put out. I think also that it doesn't go far enough. We're asking Congress to reform itself, and there's something fundamentally doubtful about that. And I think that I can echo Vern's statement about his own probity. I'm not a crook either. And I think it's important, though, that one of the big issues that we have in Congress is Congress doesn't work anymore. 2.5 days is all they're in session. Our congressman shows up on Tuesday morning and comes home on Thursday afternoon. When you have a culture not only of entitlement, which is what these folks get from this long-time service on these committees, and a culture of not doing the fundamental groundwork that Congress is required to do, passing bills on time, you end up at the end of a session with bills that are that thick that have to be passed within 24 hours because Congress hasn't done its work. We need people up there who understand that the job of Congress is the job of Congress and not back home all the time running for re-election.
All right, Al, thanks. Al, I have one question now specifically for you, and it's based on something I saw on your campaign website. It's about universal health insurance. You have been a strong proponent for universal health care, akin to what they have in Canada and Great Britain. You specifically say on your site, a single-payer universal health care system would provide all Americans with health care and do it more efficiently and affordably than the broken system we try to live with today. Could you please, Al, describe more specifically how you would convert from the current private payer system to a publicly financed system, and most importantly, tell us how you would propose to pay? Al, I'm going to give you 2 minutes on that and then Burn 1 minute to respond.
2 minutes is more than I got when I had that issue last time competing against Virgil Goode. Thanks, Tim. Well, if you read the stories about the introduction of the new Medicare reform, and then any comparative stories about the introduction of Medicare in 1965 or the late 60s. It was smooth. Medicare was put into place very smoothly and gently over time because it included everybody. It just changed the way system payments were being made and who was paying the bill. Putting it into effect in America essentially is just taking the Medicare system that we already know how it works, 3% overhead compared to 20% overhead in private systems, and making it apply to the entire country. So I don't see any difficulty of implementation. Paying for it, we as taxpayers pay for 60% right now of all the health care in America. I can explain how that is, but you're already paying for it. We pay over twice what any other industrialized country pays for its health care. So if we were only as efficient as every other country in industrialized country, we'd get a 10% savings, if I do my math right. So the cost of it is, the total cost is not the issue. It's just which pocket are we taking the money out. But that's not to be naive to say people aren't going to say, but my taxes are going to go up. And they are. It would be, there is one bill in Congress that would talk about a universal payroll tax that would pay for it. The taxes run between 4 and 6% on payroll. That's much less than any single employer today pays for health care for its employees. And the ability to make a reasonable, decent, universal system will reduce costs dramatically across the board for everyone. And so in the end, we will be saving money by going to a universal health system.
I have several goals in this. One is to make healthcare affordable. Two is to reduce the administrative overhead. And three is to get the system in place smoothly. I think Al and I would disagree on this. This is not a simple thing to do, because if it had been, it would be done by now. The question is, how much are businesses going to pay? How much is government going to pay? And how much are we going to pay as individuals? And how are we going to handle the cost for the poor to put universal health care in place? We need to put it in place. And we need to begin that process now. I think what we need in Congress is a 10-year plan with substantial change every year for the next 10 years in Medicaid, Medicare, health insurance, and debt reduction. And they all go together because you have to pay for it. There will be a substantial government contribution to this. I have had to deal with those kinds of budgets and those kinds of problems to deal with a level of service, and that's what I think I'm experienced to do.
All right, Byrne, thank you. Byrne, now for you. Let me ask you something specific about one of the items on your site. You have, Byrne, said, and I'm quoting from your website, we need to recognize that more highly trained teachers will produce a better workforce, something I'm sure we can all agree on. You go on to say that the federal government should pay for teachers' master's degrees in their core teaching areas. This program will attract young teachers and be an incentive for existing teachers to stay in the classroom. Could you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on this program? Who would qualify for the program? How would it be administered? And most importantly, how would you propose to pay for it?
We know that we're in a foot race, a very fast foot race with China and India and their well-educated workers that are competing with us. So how do we increase the performance in our schools? I think one way to do that is to go directly to the teachers and pay for their master's degree in their core area for primary and secondary education. That puts money in the teacher's pocket. That gets more qualified teachers in the classroom. So if I'm a young teacher coming out of university now, I know that will be paid for by the federal government. And I don't have the staff to tell you what it is, but I have done calculations. I think it's in the $1 billion to $2 billion a year. And lastly, what that does for us is in the Louisianas and Mississippis and so forth, those low-tax states in this country who say that they can't put enough money into education, this allows us to put the money where it belongs, to the teachers directly. I have no requirements on this being a demand or not. It would be an offer. It would be administered by the states. It would be paid at a level which is, if it's $15,000 a year to get your master's at UVA, it would be paid at a state university level. If they wanted to supplement it, they could. But I think it speaks directly to a direct solution to have better classrooms, better teachers, and to attract and also to keep, maintain teachers in the classroom who may themselves not have the money to get their master's degrees, but want to get their master's degrees.
I think it's a good idea, of course, that every teacher have an opportunity to have a graduate degree in their core subject. But if we're really concerned about teacher quality, we really have to look at fundamental issues of teacher pay. And if you're going to graduate school and you get a master's degree and it allows you to get $2,000 more a year on your salary, but your salary is $23,000 a year, we've already said to young people coming up, this is not a profession that you're going to make any money at or that we as a community value. America has not yet had the conversation that it needs to have about how we value teachers and how important they are to the schools and what we as a country will do to ensure that they get the pay they need. Anything that increases it is worth supporting and should be supported. But the big question is, how do we value teachers and are we really doing enough for them to bring the very best people into teaching that we can? We owe our children no less.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're moving on now to the portion of the program where you all can submit questions, and I see a lot of cards circulating. That's good news. I'm going to attempt to kind of group these questions and get some sort of general themes and get everybody's question answered, even if it's not exactly verbatim as written on the card. Now, 2 minutes to each of you on some of these questions. Let me start with a question that was submitted about the environment. The card reads, "The current administration and many members of Congress have waged a campaign to dismantle the environmental protections and policies enacted 30-plus years ago. If elected, what would you do to reverse this trend and promote responsible stewardship of our natural resources?" Why don't we start, Al, with you for 2 minutes.
Well, clearly I recognize what the administration has been doing, any of us does, and clearly I wouldn't have voted for those things. I had an interesting conversation in Brookneal the other day to a man who owns a small restaurant that gets traffic off of Highway 501 there. And he was talking about how in the spring the stripers used to come up out of Kerr Lake all the way up to Brookneal, and the place would be packed with fishermen. And his business was obviously benefiting from this fishing. And he said, it's not there anymore. He said, the PCBs in the river have destroyed the fishing. And I said, you know, Virgil voted against the funding for the EPA to clean up this river. He said, no, I didn't know that. I said, well, now you know it, and you ought to tell your friends. It was amazing, you know, the sense of understanding about how the environment does appeal to ordinary people. It's not a high-level thing. So I think it's very important that we go in and fight for the environment, not just for our own self-satisfaction, but because ordinary people's lives are affected by lousy air and lousy water. The biofuels program that we're talking about for Southside or for all the agricultural areas in the state would not only have a great impact on the local economy and revitalize the economy down there, it would also reduce dramatically the amount of energy dependence we have on imported oil. But fundamentally, it is also an environmental impact. It would reduce air and water pollution, it would reduce soil erosion, and it would change the nature of those economies. And I think that's an important thing to work for in Congress.
Well, the first thing we can do on the environment, which we should have done 20 years ago, was to put mandated fuel efficiency standards in place for the automobiles that every one of us drive. And stop giving Detroit a way out. Coulda, woulda, shoulda, maybe, you know, now is the time, do it, and let's get on with it. That's the first thing we can do, and we should do. In terms of fuel efficiency and independence, we've got plenty of coal in this country, and I can't speak to whether or not the technology now is where it needs to be at the EPA level, but that's certainly something that we should look at and we should support now. When I became city manager of Roanoke, the federal government had paid a major share of the cost of the tertiary treatment plant that was run by the region and which discharged into Smith Mountain Lake and then down into the bays and into the ocean. Those funds made it possible for those local governments to put a tertiary, the highest level plant in, and those are the kinds of specific targeted things I think we should do, and I am committed to clean air and clean water and making it happen.
Great, thanks. And we're going to do 2 minutes each for these that are directed to both. You only got a minute. If there's more you want to say, yeah, please. If you have more to say on the environment, please.
We know that things can be done at the local level, and we know that our governor is looking at doing things at the state level right now in terms of adequate public facilities. Certainly we can encourage Tim Kaine and our elected officials at the state level to put that bill in place. I didn't think I would ever see it happen. But I'm excited that it did. Tim has taken a leadership role for us, and I think it's that kind of leadership role we need to take in Congress. But it's going to require working together. You know, no one person can do it by themselves. It's going to require someone working in coalitions, Republican and Democrat, in Congress to make these new laws go into place and to stop the rollback and the destruction of the air and water in this country. And I would work every day and very hard to make that happen.
All right, Byrne, thanks. We're getting a lot of questions about Iraq and foreign policy. Not surprisingly, I can read them all, but the theme is similar. Consensus is that it's a mess in Iraq, and each of you have called for a timetable of withdrawal. I've talked a little bit about the faulty intelligence and the mistakes that were made in getting us there. If you could, each for 2 minutes, tell us a little bit more about specifically how you would propose extricating or fixing the mess in Iraq. What specifically would you as a congressman try to accomplish with respect to the conflict in Iraq? Let's start on this one with Byrne.
So it's a horrible mess. We were given the wrong information. Weapons of mass destruction and terrorism, the president's and Secretary Powell's information to us was wrong. We went in. We have created a living hell for the Iraqis. There is, in good parts of that country right now, anarchy. Our troops are the only thing that's holding it together. But I believe that people have to have deadlines and timetables. And my timetable that I have proposed is November of 07, that we should have transitioned from now till then into an international community, international peacekeeping force, if that's what the Iraqis want, and we should move out. The Iraqis need to know that they are responsible for their own country, and only they can bring the security that they need. But when General Casey, our leading commander in Iraq, says that we are, our very presence is a mere, is a cause, and our mere presence is one of the major causes of the terrorism over there, it makes you realize that given military advice and judgment from our leadership on the ground, that we need to get out as quickly as we can, given all the other provisos I've just mentioned. And I recommended 24 months as that time period. It's a difficult situation because they have given us the most difficult possible situation we could have by going into Iraq on a war of choice and not a war of necessity, and diverted us from focusing on the real issue, which is the war on terrorism worldwide.
George Bush said that in 2002, the election was a referendum on his going into Iraq. George Bush has said that in 2004, the election was a referendum on his staying in Iraq. 2006, my friend, is a referendum on us getting the hell out of Iraq. But we don't accomplish that unless we find a way to make that case to the American public. Asking Byrne and me what our timetable for withdrawal is not very efficient because we're not there. We're not going to get it. How do we sell this message to the people who are going to vote for us? That's the crucial key question. And my answer to that is fairly simple. One, I don't want to see our military destroyed in a futile war. We need that military. We need that force. There are enemies out there who hate us. In fact, Mr. Al-Qaeda himself was on the airways just the other day, and we're not doing anything about that because our military is tied down. That war is going to cost us, some now estimate, $2 trillion. That's such a big number, people can't imagine what it matters. But it matters a lot in the future of every person in America, both in their payment of the debt and what they will not be able to accomplish with public monies. That war is being fought by the working and middle class people of America. It is not a shared sacrifice. They are not sacrificing, rich people are not sacrificing either in wealth or their children. Poor people are. That's the message that's going to be the referendum, the basis for a referendum in 2006. That's the message that I want to bring to the people of the 5th District.
All right, we've gotten several questions about the economy in Southside. You've already talked a little bit about your economic plans, but people still want to know, what, if anything, will you propose about development in the rural areas of Southside, housing, business, et cetera? How would you facilitate people here helping Southside? And how would you get voters in Southside, Virginia, to vote for you? Why don't we start, Al, with you for 2 minutes.
Well, the challenge, of course, is getting voters to vote for you. But the even bigger challenge is to make sure that they know you care. Because someone once said they don't care for you until they know you care for them. Or they don't care what you think until they know what you care, that you care for them. So getting people in Southside to talk about their problems, which I have been doing now constantly since the beginning of the year, in which I plan to do a great deal of. We already have people organizing in those regions to help us develop a campaign. And the ideas I have are very simply the new college in Martinsville, which I may get a chance to talk about a little later, will have a slight impact in Martinsville, but its economic impact. But its role there is not so much economic, but human. It is a message to people of Martinsville, Henry County, that they can do something to create their own future. And that's an important message to people who've been pushed back and pushed down and pushed back. This is something they can bring themselves up with. And they know it's not going to solve all their problems, but they want it badly. And Virgil has been dead silent on the new College of Virginia, has not said a word. I think he's afraid that he might give Democrats some credit if he admits that it's a good idea. In Danville, we're talking about a world-class research university that will generate jobs, that will generate new knowledge, that will put pressure on the education system to develop children to face the 21st century. A university with 10,000 students will have an impact of $200 million into the regional economy down there. This nation owes it to these trade-impacted areas to do something to compensate for things like NAFTA and CAFTA and everything else. And we haven't done it. We haven't done it one bit. And that's something that our congressman has never gone to Congress to argue for. They voted on CAFTA the other day. He's a Republican. They desperately wanted his vote because they wanted to get the bill passed. He stood up strong. I'm going to vote against CAFTA. It passed, and he didn't ask for a single darn thing. He didn't say, I'll vote for it if you give my district something, because he didn't have a single thing to ask for. Biofuels, an ethanol-based regional refinery producing 50 million gallons a year, will generate the equivalent in income in that region of $2,500, $10 an hour jobs. That is a crucial difference in what we can do.
Well, I think you've just heard the major difference between the two campaigns, and I will capsulize that if I can. It sounds good in Charlottesville to say that we're going to pull out now out of Iraq, and to say that the war is the defining issue in this campaign. And that sounds good here. My belief is that if that is my position, and it is not my position in Southside, where 2/3 of the population is, that we will lose. It is my belief that this campaign will be won on the basis of jobs. Now, Al has just proposed two new universities, not one, but two. Is that right?
No, one's a college, one's a university.
There is a difference. Yeah. Often people...
Well, I understand. I just want to be sure I got it straight. So, but it's two four-year institutions, two new four-year institutions?
One new four-year institution, one new graduate, starting at the upper level.
Okay, I'm...
It's okay. Not two new universities. It's one four-year college.
All right, I had 10,000 students in one and a large number in the other. If we're lucky to get one of those, and the money is going to come from the state, then we'll be very lucky indeed. And we can talk about ethanol and biofuels and those kinds of programs. And the United States Congress has been talking about them for 20 years, particularly out of the Midwest. But what they're looking for, ladies and gentlemen, is an organization that will recruit industry and bring industry in today to create new jobs today because they're unemployed today. They're not interested in the year 2016. They're interested in today, in jobs today. And I've lived in that environment, attracting jobs. And I wouldn't say that they want any job, because you don't just get any job if you build a new plant. But they want a range of jobs. Because after all, most of the workers down there are high school graduates. And there are your two major distinctions. And I believe that I can win on jobs and strengthening and expanding the middle class. And, of course, I'm on record on a timetable for getting out of Iraq.
Byrne, your last answer sort of anticipates another couple of questions we've gotten about economic justice and equality. A couple of people have written, in the aftermath of Katrina, the two Americas that John Edwards described were overwhelmingly apparent. What would you do, what do you see as the role of government in addressing the gross inequities of our economic system? We also got a related question about raising the minimum wage. How can we use the living wage raising the minimum wage to bring together all Virginians and make America greater. Byrne, why don't you start and tell us a little bit about your views on the living wage and economic justice, and then Al will give you 2 minutes as well.
We should increase the minimum wage. We should have done it a long time ago. I got into this business in 1971 because I was in the civil rights movement. Equal rights for women. You know, when I went to graduate school, my wife got paid half by Macy's of what the man next to her got paid. Black people and African Americans not having jobs in Charlottesville. People living two blocks from City Hall who didn't have indoor plumbing. No senior people in positions in Charlottesville or Roanoke. I spent 13 years integrating those two governments. Women, did you know that in 1971, if you were a divorced woman, that the personnel department in the city of Charlottesville wouldn't hire you, wouldn't interview you? The late Helen Poor told me that story. So I have a long record in social justice. I've been there. I did it. I care about it. It's in my soul. I believe that we have to pay a fair wage. Of course we do. Poverty rate in this country has gone from 11% to 12% in the last year. That's a serious, serious issue. We've got people living on the edge. They don't have affordable health care. They can't afford gasoline. They don't have a job. Those are the bread and butter issues that scare people. It scares the life out of them. They're on a yo-yo. I've explained to you previously where I stand and what I do. I care about them deeply. It's why I'm in public service. It's why I've stayed in public service, and it's why I hope I'll get your support.
The issue of jobs is, there's no question that people want jobs. But I remind you that 2006 is different from 1985 in manufacturing. And the jobs that were easily flowed to the low-wage sectors in America, which is what Byrne is referring to in Roanoke relative to the rest of the country pre-1985, they're not flown there anymore, folks. If they're not going to Mexico, they're going straight to China. That whole world has changed. And everybody in Southside understands that, that we do not have a future if all we're doing is attracting low-wage jobs. Local governments down there are working their butts off to get the low-wage jobs here. A congressman needs to have a bigger vision, has to have a vision for the future, has to have a vision that includes social justice, that includes a living wage for everyone, that includes inclusive communities. And that's what the congressman will do who talks about a hope and a future of hope and not, well, maybe we can get Joe Blow to bring his factory down here and pay you guys $8.50 an hour. Gee, thanks, we already had that. Let's try something new.
Al, stay here, Al. I want to ask you first. Another question about the economy. Please, go ahead. Very quickly, Byrne.
We got high-tech jobs. We got Johnson & Johnson. We got all kinds of high-paying jobs in Roanoke when I was city manager. Al, that's a factual misstatement. But we got a range of jobs because there's a range of needs.
On the subject of the economy, we got a question about tax cuts for high-income people. What is your opinion, and this is directed to both of you, but we'll start with Al, of tax cuts for high-income people on the inheritance tax specifically? Al, do you have any thoughts that you could share with us about tax policy?
Well, this nation was built, the economic strength of this nation was built, I believe, on a progressive tax system. It was a community of taxpayers and a community of Americans investing in our future. Republicans have chipped away at that. And you know where the tax cuts are going. 97% of the tax cuts that they're being contemplated now go to those making more than $200,000 a year. I would ask all the people in this room who are going to benefit from those tax cuts to raise their hands, but you might be embarrassed. So, what was the other part of the question?
The
inheritance tax. That's the biggest scam that's ever been put forward, and it's been put forward wonderfully. In the last round when I was debating this with Virgil, I said there's never been a farmer who's lost his farm because of the inheritance tax. They've never been able to find one. And he said, well, farmers must back it because the Farm Bureau says they would like to see it. The inheritance tax is just another way to make sure that people who have it keep it. And I believe people in this district understand, if they're spoken to, that why should Dale Earnhardt Jr. get the pole position his father earned for the rest of his career. And that's what this means, is people whose families earned it always have an advantage over those who didn't earn it.
I think what Al just said is well stated and certainly is to the point. And it brings us, and I agree with that, I'm not going to repeat it. I agree with everything he just said. It brings us to the real issue, which is the federal budget. It's going to take more money for health insurance. It's going to take more money to resolve the Medicaid problem. It's going to take more money to resolve the debt problem. Now, you know, it takes no brains to cut taxes, ladies and gentlemen. It takes no brains at all. Anybody can cut taxes. What takes brains is to be able to balance basic services. And it's the middle class and the poor that have been hurt by this administration. To cut taxes and balance basic services. And when we cut the real estate rate in Roanoke from $1.60 to $1.30, at the same time we were expanding the police department, expanding the neighborhood programs, and so forth and so on. It's that balancing and building of coalitions. Now, we've got to roll those taxes back. We've got to get the revenues back to where we were. But it's going to be very difficult to balance the budget. I've had to balance billion-dollar budgets. I've had to balance social services, public works, up and down the line, and put them together. And it all goes together. No one piece can be segmented out. That's the problem with the way we budget today, is we'll take a piece out that we all agree on and never ask the question in Congress, what impact does that have on the rest of the budget? What impact does that have over the next 5 to 10 years? I'm afraid most of the answers to any of these new programs, or virtually all of these new programs, is going to be no until we get the budget balanced and deal with the basics of health care, the poor, Medicaid, and the debt.
We got a question about same-sex marriage that I want to ask. There's apparently been a proposal to cement in the Constitution, in the form of a constitutional amendment, the concept that marriage is a union between a man and a woman. The question is, will you vote against discrimination in the Constitution? Will you campaign to allow loving same-sex couples to marry? Why don't we start, Byrne, with you? Each of you can have 2 minutes on this.
I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. I don't, and I will not support the constitutional amendment that's being proposed to cement that into the United States Constitution. I'm opposed to that. I do support the rights of couples who are living together to have living wills, transfer of property, and all of the other kinds of legal rights that I have with my wife and my family. I think they have every right to have that. But I don't support gay marriage.
Probably the issue of the state amendment on same-sex marriage or traditional marriage will be on the ballot in 2006. So the person you pick to run for Congress, whether he likes it or not, is going to be facing that issue at every stop we make. And so how we deal with that, I think, should be a way that you all consider us. I said last time and I said this time that marriage is an issue for the church to determine. In my church, I'm Episcopalian. It's a sacrament. And I don't want the government telling my church how to define marriage any more than I want the government to tell my church who can be divorced and who shouldn't be divorced. And that's what these amendments do. They take a sacrament and embody it into the Constitution. I don't think the staunchest Southern Baptist who is opposed to same-sex marriage really wants the government telling his church what he has to do. Suppose it were the other way around. Suppose the constitutional amendment were to require those who marry anyone legally would have to marry same-sex couples. Can you imagine the uproar that that would cause? The point is, this does not belong in our law. We have a whole range of laws, however, that are unfair to loving couples of any makeup. And they do need to be changed. And that's the issue that we should face, is do we find it in our hearts? Can we find any good reason to discriminate against people because of the way they decide to lead their lives? I think not. I don't think we can build a strong nation by saying sorry, you guys are part of another part of our community. The same-sex amendments, I would vote against, but they are an effort to enshrine bigotry in our constitutions, and I would never support it.
Al, a couple members of our audience have some specific questions about lessons maybe you learned having done this before. Specifically, did you learn, Al, what may have cost you votes the last time so that you will not make those mistakes again? Good question. And Al, in light of the results of the last campaign, how do you think you can overcome Virgil's popularity in the Southside area? Let me give you 2 minutes to respond, and then anything at all, Byrne, that you want to respond to, you can have some time.
Well, in all humility, 2 minutes is not enough time to tell you what I learned. It's not that I'm a fast learner or a good learner. It's just there was a lot to learn. The analogy I like to use is it's like learning to ride a bicycle. The first time you get on that bicycle and try to go from here to there, you're wobbly. You're not sure how it works. You're not sure the strength of the gears or whatever. And it's not clear exactly how to operate that bicycle. Eventually, we all learn, most of us, to ride a bicycle. But eventually, sometimes there's more than one campaign. And that's what this is about. This is about somebody who knows how to ride the bicycle now, friends, knows how to steer it, and knows which direction it ought to be going. I can't guarantee it'll be fast enough at the end to overtake Virgil Goode. But I can tell you it's not going to waver, it's not going to deviate, and it's going to know where it's going. That's what I learned from that last campaign. And Virgil's weaknesses now are becoming more and more apparent. It's clear that he's no longer just the good old boy that is noted for the frugality and the piece of log he has for a desk in Washington. He's also somebody who has had his hand out in every case. I had a meeting the other morning with a big backer of Virgil. But that man is very practical and very pragmatic. He says, Virgil has been bringing the bacon home for us from Washington. And I said, what if he doesn't go back? He said, then our investment is screwed. And they see him strictly as someone who will do their bidding in Washington. I can't promise them that, but I can promise them that if Virgil doesn't go back, they will still have somebody who cares about what they care about. Virgil's weaknesses are becoming more and more apparent every day, and what people need to turn to is somebody they know, somebody they have seen in their homes, on their streets, in their communities, at their meetings, at their banquets, who has been out there for the last 2 years and say, oh, I know him. I'll vote for him. That's the difference.
It's a very interesting process to run a campaign and to choose the issues and to answer questions. And I think I heard someone else say this before I did. It's not unlike your marriage. You and your spouse don't agree on all issues, and there are going to be issues that I'm going to put forward that you don't agree on as well, and things that you may support that I don't agree on. So there's that, but I hope we can look at the core of it. And I think that the core of it in Southside is who can get elected, who's got a record that the people of Southside will look at and say, you know, he did it. He did what we care about. He did it there. He did it in Roanoke. He created jobs in Roanoke of all pay ranges, high income to middle income. He rebuilt the downtown. This is a guy that listened to us, that came and talked to us, and that changed his positions if he thought that what we suggested was a better way to go. That's where we are in Southside right now. That's where it will turn. Al or I will both do well up here. Al may do better than me up here. I couldn't say. But it's Southside and the jobs and the middle class and the people who are frightened down there, whether they have a good job or not. And I've talked to people who have good jobs, and they say to me, we're scared, Byrne. We don't know what's going to happen because of what's happening all around us. So who is going to be the most reliable candidate in terms of their record? And I'm the only candidate in this race, including Virgil Goode, who has a record of job creation and has shown that you can that I can do it and I can rebuild communities. Roanoke was getting ready to blow away in 1978. It's a strong community now. They'd like it to be stronger, but we vastly changed it through a coalition of business, community, and government, and that's what we need to do in Southside.
We've got a couple of very good questions about values and what our party should stand for. For the past year on the national political stage, the Democratic Party has elevated lack of cohesion to an art form. How are you going to respond when Virgil Goode attacks you as representing a party that doesn't really stand for anything? Also, both of you are very cognizant of the needs of the Fifth, but to wrest this seat from Goode, you need to understand the minds of these folks who vote Republican time after time. So how will you go about changing the hearts and faulty perceptions of these folks? Byrne, why don't we start with you and talk a little bit about Democratic values and principles.
As long as I've been a Democrat, as long as I've been involved, we've cared about the poor and the middle class. We've cared about families. We've cared about giving people a real opportunity, a real institutional opportunity in schools and in their neighborhoods and with jobs to develop their God-given talents. And that we are not subject to the pressures that can be brought to bear by the very rich and the very wealthy, or whatever interest group that is only concerned about a narrow segment. That's what I believe in, and that's what my record is, and that's what I think Democrats are. We wouldn't have the city of Charlottesville as we do today. So hard to remember what it looked like when Mitch Vanieri's walked in the door in 1968, all the people that supported him and that city council. Wouldn't have the Roanoke that we have today, where my personnel, I hired the first and second African-American personnel director in the city of Roanoke. And the second went on to become a senior vice president for Coca-Cola bottling, making an awful lot of money, supervising 75,000 people. That's what we're about, is a hand up for people and recognizing people's talent and giving them a chance to make it in schools and across the board. That's what I've committed my life to, and that's what I believe in. And that's what we need to do in Congress, and the Democrats need to get back to that. And I believe the way that we get back to that is with the theme that says, strengthen and expand the middle class in health care, education, clean environment, and those programs that we've discussed today. And yes, go back and protect and look after the poor that we did, but help them move into the middle class, which is what everybody wants and what everybody hopes, where everybody hopes to be.
Some of you know I've spent the last year working on the values issue and the values language and how to communicate what we all believe, but we've often been a little bit awkward at saying or a little bit difficult approaching and using the language that people respond to, using the language of the Bible, which is important to many people. I suspect it's important to most people in this room as well. We don't need to be afraid of it. We need to find the language that connects. People vote Republican in the 5th District, most of them, in my experience, because that's what they know. Virgil Goode is a name that they know. If they don't know the name, they're going to pull the name that they do. We all know, we're sitting here on a Saturday morning in January, we're political junkies. 80% of the world doesn't care one whit about politics. A small portion of that goes to vote. They don't care anymore just because they go to vote, or do they know anymore? They know what they've seen on television. They know what they've heard from their neighbors. The way you overcome that is to talk about what matters to them as individuals, to stress the values that we have, and Byrne did a fine job of laying those out. I'm not going to reiterate that. And getting into people where they live. I can tell you this. When I ran last time, if I had been given the opportunity to speak in a white Baptist church, as I was given and am always given an opportunity to speak in black Baptist churches, I would have been very nervous about how I did that, how I would go and face this, what would be perceived to be a hostile group. I'm finding it's not so hard, folks. They share the same values we share. You get the language, you get the commonality, you'll get the votes.
Very, very practical question, and it's so practical we'll limit your responses to a minute each. How much money do you think you need to raise in order to beat Goode in this election? Al, you've got more experience with this. Why don't you start?
You never raise enough because at least so far he's always able to raise more. And in fact, the better a challenger does against an incumbent, the more they pour onto the incumbent because they're protecting their base. I think we can run a good, strong campaign, and based on our experience last time, what we won't spend money on, what we will spend money on, I think we can run a good, strong campaign on $600,000. Now, I've counted the house. If each of you will drop $1,000 before you leave, we'll be there. Well, that's not enough. $10,000. Yeah, you can't do that legally. Sorry. I think $500,000 to $600,000 spent wisely, hoarded to the end so you can spend it on television where people are paying attention, will overcome Virgil. We're not going to overcome him by beating him to death with ads. We're going to overcome him by beating him to death on the ground with better organization, with better get out the vote, with better appeals directly to particular constituency groups. Those are the kind of things you learn when you run a campaign, is how to do that field organization. We're looking forward to doing it again.
I think Al is right. It's going to take organization. My campaign manager worked in the Cain and Kerry campaigns, and my finance director worked in the Democratic senatorial campaigns, the Virginia senatorial campaigns. How much money? $600,000 to $1 million. How do we get the money? We know how we get the money from each other. I guess the question is, will the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee come in and put money into the campaign? That's the question. Will we get a commitment from them? And we will only get a commitment from them if they believe that the Democratic candidate has a chance to win. As I mentioned to you before, and you've heard a lot of numbers here this morning, I want to say it again, because having a debate with Mitch Vanieri's one day, I actually went home and started figuring out how many times I had been on regional television from 1978 to 1993. And the number is 3,000 times. I was on television 3,000 times in Southside, because Roanoke is the media center. And what was I doing? I was rebuilding a decaying city and doing all and supporting all of the issues that we've talked about here with a mayor who was African American. That's what I was doing, and that's how I'm remembered. And if I'm not remembered, that's what I can remind them of when I get into the campaign in Southside.
All right, last question from the cards before we move on to the next portion of the program, and I purposefully saved this one for last. Will each of you pledge to actively support the winning Democratic candidate to defeat the incumbent Virgil Goode? Byrne, start with you.
Absolutely. I supported Al Weed last time, and I'd be delighted to support him again this time.
Ditto. And I don't mean that funny. I will support him.
That's the main thing, and what both of us are saying, we got to win this time.
All right, next portion of the program, which is very brief, is that each of you have an opportunity to ask a question of each other. Since, Al, you had this job, or at least this role before, let me ask Byrne first to ask you a question. Anything at all, Byrne, that you want to ask Al, please do, and Al, you'll have 2 minutes to respond. Then, Al, you'll have a chance to ask Byrne a question.
Well, I was going to ask Al how he was going to make up the 14 points. I think he's already answered that question. Maybe I'd ask you this, Al. What could you do specifically over the next 5 years, if you're elected to Congress, to generate jobs in the next 5 years in Southside?
Well, I talked about that, didn't I? And I don't think that's the time frame a congressman should be focusing on. A congressman should be supporting localities in everything they do to get that done. But I'm running to be your representative in the U.S. Congress. I am not running as 5th District Manager. That is not the job of a congressman. I am running to encourage people, to bring people together, to get them out of their own self-constrained or self-imposed limitations and see that there is a future for them, that there is a voice, that there is somebody in Washington who will listen to them, who will hear their aspirations and work to further them. That's the job, in my view, of a congressman. So I don't have a particular answer, Byrne, to that question, because I don't think it's my job to answer that question. Now, my question.
Yes.
Fair enough. All of your experience, which we've heard you describe, has been in urban or very well-developed suburban areas, Prince William County. So presumably all of your connections are in those communities. Yet this is a very rural district. And this is a district where people, if they aren't still on the farm and aren't still in the villages of our district, are only one generation or one decade away from living there. How will you make your experience work to communicate with people in these conditions?
Let's go through some of the numbers. Franklin County is 25,000 people. It's suburban to Roanoke. People work in Roanoke. It's part of the district. Bedford County is somewhere over 60,000 people now. That's 85,000 people who work in Roanoke and relate to Roanoke. Danville is 55,000 people. That's 940,000. Martinsville at 12,000. It is not simply a rural community. It is a community, whether it be rural or urban, where people are looking for the same thing. They have chosen that lifestyle. Many of them are retirees, and the Social Security issue, I believe, is how you communicate with them. We have the 40th largest number of Social Security retirees of any congressional district in the United States, and Virgil has raided $1.5 trillion out of that fund. It's the only place in America where you could do this and not get fined or put in jail. And I think we can identify with people who are receiving Social Security on that issue. And I think I can identify with the other people because of the place that Roanoke plays. It's the largest city west of Richmond in Virginia. People go there to work. People go there to shop. People go there for health insurance and so forth. So it's not like they are dislocated or truncated from each other. People look at it, know it, remember it, and it is a beginning and a touch point. When I was being interviewed in Danville by a reporter on December the 3rd, when I made my announcement, he said, "I used to watch you on television." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, I lived in Appomattox and was watching you on television. Now I live in Chatham." People in that area are not disconnected. They are connected, and there is a respect for one place to the other.
All right, we have a few minutes within our allotted time now to allow some of you to ask questions. Yes, now
I'd like to bring up one, and I'm a little disappointed. Great things have been said, but one of the great commitments of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party has been to the Civil Rights Movement, to righting the wrongs that have been done to black people, and almost nothing's been said about that. Let me just ask one specific question, and then you guys go on from others. George Allen's economic development program was centered in building prisons, and his home building program was centered in putting black people in. And we have this extraordinary unfairness, discrimination, in the way we lock up this minority population. What would you guys do in Congress to see to it that drug laws and others did not unfairly incarcerate the black population? And then how would you use that to appeal to your black constituents? Because they got to vote for it.
Let me give each of you a minute quickly to respond to that. Why don't we start with you, Al?
Everywhere I've gone, I've spoken to Democrats and voters everywhere. But clearly, we as Democrats understand that part of our base has been, as long as we are faithful and loyal and do deliver, has been the African-American community. We have a better record there, and we ought to understand that what our relationship to that community is. They are part of us. We are part of them. I can only say, Paul, I spent all my life in the military never seeing color, and it's sometimes difficult for me to answer those questions because I don't see color. But I think it's an absolutely vital point. And the difference is that we will have a congressman, and I suspect Byrne would be the same person. We will have a congressman in Washington who listens to everyone in this district. I'll tell you a quick story. In 2003, the 50th anniversary of the commemoration of and all the commemoration ceremonies of Brown versus Board of Education. And as many of you know, this district includes one of the very first cases that was rolled up into that, the Prince Edward case. Very vital to the history of our district. Very vital to the feeling of people's own sense of their history. And I must have gone to six or eight of those events in the period of time they were doing it. I never saw Mr. Goode at one of them. And that message was, I don't need your votes. I don't want to hear your voices. I don't need your input. And that's the difference. That's what we can do. Working to change drug laws is just the next step when you start to listen to people as we will do.
Some astronomical number of people, I heard it the other night. I can't say it's true, but I don't disbelieve it, that 90% of the African-American population in prison is there for a nonviolent reason, which has to do with the way people are defended. It has to do with the lawyers they have, and not just the way they're being arrested, but how they're defended. I'm surprised, Paul, to hear you say we haven't talked about civil rights. I have talked about civil rights. Well, I have a record in civil rights. I have a record in civil rights. I have a record in Roanoke of rebuilding a community 25% black. Civil rights. It's an issue that I care about. And to say, generally, I would say this. You know, I'm out to listen to what people have to say, to try to find solutions to the problems that they identify, to find better ways to do what we do as a nation, and I have a record of doing that. I will never see, before I'm buried, equal rights in this country. That's a given. And I will work till the day I die on bringing equal rights to the extent that I can to this country and on the programs in Congress that can make things better for all Americans, regardless of their background.
All right.
This is for Byrne concerning the November 07 timetable in Iraq. If we're in Iraq until 07, November, that will become the fourth longest war the U.S. has ever been in, exceeded only by the Vietnam War, the Revolutionary War, and the current war in Afghanistan, which has already exceeded our involvement in World War II and our Civil War. What are we going to accomplish in Iraq from January 07 to November 07 that we can't accomplish by the end of this year?
My senior political advisor, I mean military advisor, is a retired brigadier general. And he said, Byrne, the thing that everyone has to realize is moving 165,000 troops out of Iraq is no small undertaking. And that can only be done by the military and ensuring that the military can do it. What we're now saying is, what I'm saying is that, number one, that's a difficult process. You don't just pull a switch and have everybody come home. Number two, it has to be done in an orderly process so it doesn't look like we're turning around and running out of the country. And number three, it has to be done in a way to maintain civil order in the country as we're moving out of the country. Listen, I didn't invent this war. I'm just telling you how I think we should get out of it. And I think it could get worse, and everybody I hear says they think it could get worse, who know about it think it could get worse if we walk out tomorrow. So I think it's an orderly process to get it done the best that we can do.
Okay, Al, 1 minute on the timetable of withdrawal.
Well, it's an unfair position to put Democrats in to say, how are you going to get us out of this war? We didn't get you into the damn war. And so we can debate about timetables and general movement. What we need is a clear statement from the public to get out. And when that clear statement from the public is made, Congress will figure out how to get it out. I disagree with Byrne. I know a little bit about moving military forces. We can get out a lot faster. If we have to, we can get out off of the roof of the embassy. Let's hope that's not the case. Compare recent movements of lots of people. New Orleans was evacuated in 10 days, 400,000 people. Now, we don't want to duplicate that. But the point is, moving large amounts of disciplined people a short distance, which is basically into Kuwait, in the gutter, and out into the port areas in the Gulf states, is not hard to do. And we can do it in a lot sooner than 2 years. And I disagree with Byrne that we are going to maintain order all the time this is happening. As some of you have pointed out, we don't have order there now. And it's going to get worse, not better. And I think that we need to recognize that.
A couple more questions. Yes, sir.
This morning, Washington Post, there was an article about Rove speaking at the Republican National Party, and he called Democrats, anyhow, Democrats are the outsiders. The Republicans know the
way.
Yeah,
pre-9/11 and post-9/11. Yeah.
Yes, but my point is that Rove is setting the stage for how the Republicans will lockstep in their replies to or talking about Democrats. Okay. So how are you going to respond to that kind of Rove letter fighting? You're an awfully nice guy. I like you very much, and I voted for you, but this is really tough with a guy like that still in power.
I actually was on my stomach getting shot at in Vietnam. I understand what it means to be in a tough fight. I understand what's involved in facing up to an enemy who will give very little quarter or none. I'm not afraid of a tough fight. In fact, I'm looking forward to it. My problem with Virgil was the son of a gun would never stand still. You know, we never had a chance to fight. Maybe the Rovian discipline will get him to stand up there thinking he's got something to say. I would love that. You didn't get a chance to let me answer a question about how would we deal with a question by Virgil about our party. My God, he has to defend the Republican Party? Let them go lockstep. That's the best target. What did the guy say in the Battle of the Bastogne? You're surrounded, General. No, I'm not. I've just got opportunity in every direction. I think that's where it is.
The other thing he said in that article this morning in the Post was that they should cut taxes more. That's the other thing he said. You look, we're already running the largest deficits in history, and Rove is calling for more tax cuts. We've got to bring the impact of that to the dinner table in Southside, and the impact of that is in Social Security, Medicare, the lack of health care, and those kinds of issues that people are affected by. We've got to bring it home and make it hurt so the people of Southside understand exactly what the Republicans are proposing for the next 2 years. And I think I can do that. I've had to do that with 15 municipal budgets.
Yes, sir, in the back. Stand up. Thank you. You're next.
I want to direct my question to Vern and Al. And the question, Vern, you've been very active in civil rights, you said. You were concerned about the number of blacks that were incarcerated. Now I'm concerned about one thing. Those blacks who were incarcerated, and there are many, many, many of them have served their time. They've paid their debt to society. They're out, but they can't vote. What's your position on that? It seems to me that this is important.
Yeah.
It's important.
Let's start with Byrne. The issue is restoration of rights, voting, and otherwise for felons. Byrne, give us your position on that.
I think that's a state issue, isn't it, Mitch? Yeah. It's a state issue, and the issue of giving voting rights back to felons. You're talking about felons.
Ex-felons.
You know, I'm really not up on that issue, I have to tell you. And I'd be happy to talk to people about what the answer should be. I know Mitch has been on record for many years on that issue, that the voting rights ought to come back. And I'm just going to have to think about that and get back to you.
All right, hold on. You have a follow-up, sir? Go ahead.
When you say that you are running for an office and you're not concerned about people who are not denied the right to vote, who pay their dues, are you saying that to me?
I don't think I said that. I think what I said...
You indicated that. Go ahead. Tell me this.
I think what I said was, I want to talk to people about it specifically and come up with a position on it. That's what I said. And I'm very proud of my position in civil rights, and I think everybody here should know that we're not up on every single issue that's out there.
Al, let me give you a chance to respond to the issue of restoration of rights.
restoration of rights?
I know it's a state issue, and I know it's a matter of justice. Other states, in fact, allow people to vote in prison. So it's not an issue of whether or not people who have been convicted of a crime are irresponsible citizens. In this state, it has traditionally been a way to keep black felons from voting, and in Republicans in the General Assembly have said, and Mitch, you probably heard it, if we do more on prison rights of felons to vote, it's just going to mean more Democrats, and the Republicans are opposed to it. So while it is a state issue, it is something that I know something about. I've heard people on it, and in whatever place, whatever kind of bully pulpit a congressman has, that'll be something I'm talking about.
Ma'am, you've been patient. Let me get your question.
Al Gore gave a very important speech the other day that I hope you all heard or read about, and he's talking about the way this administration has perhaps gone a bit far in its authority. Congress has not been very effective at standing up to this administration on lots of things. I would like to hear each of you comment about that this issue that is raging right now and what Congress might do about it.
I read the Gore speech, and I think it's wonderful to see him come out of his shell.
Yes.
And if this is not a reason to bring a national leader out of their shell, we probably never will have one. It is a crucial constitutional issue. And it is not even... Although Congress, Republicans in Congress will try to make it, it is not a bipartisan issue. It is a issue for all Americans. And I think the idea that the president can break the law because he's the commander in chief is fundamentally contradictory to all of our own history and our own constitutional background. So we have to stand up against that. We have to question the president on that and not be cowed by guys like Rove and others that say, well, we're fighting a war. You've got to be, you know, you got to let us do what we got to do. I've even heard Democrats say that. That's wrong. We're fighting a war for our freedom. We can't give our freedoms away to fight the war.
The Foreign Intelligence FISA, F-I-S-A, I can't come up with the S now, Act. Yeah. Surveillance? Yeah. It was passed in 1978. It was a bipartisan effort. There's a provision in that law that allows the government, if they need to do a wiretap or some kind of surveillance, to do that. But within a period of time, they can get back to the court to have it approved. That provision is already in the act. You know, Rove is saying we hear a terrorist on the phone, we're not supposed to listen. They're supposed to get back to the court and get authorization for what they've done. They have ignored the act. Not only have they ignored the act, if they didn't think the act would work, they should have gone to Congress and said, here's how we think the act should be modified. So once again, it's really a very high-handed approach on the Bush presidency, where they're ignoring the law. This is a bipartisan law passed by Republicans and Democrats, and going down a road that is, may very well, it's certainly illegal. And I haven't heard anybody other than partisan Republicans say that they have the authority to do it. I don't think he has the authority to do what he needs to do. And if the law needs to be changed, then he ought to make the recommendation on how it should be changed.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are way over time. We're Democrats, though. We need to air everything. And it's been a spirited discussion, but you all each get the last word. We have allotted time for each of you to give a closing statement. I think Al went first with respect to opening, so, Byrne, why don't you give us your 2 minutes, and then, Al, you can have the last word.
I just wanted to thank everybody for coming, and I want to thank you for your questions. It's always instructive to get questions and to get hard-hitting questions. We need real solutions in this country to our problems. The middle class and the poor Americans deserve real solutions and not empty sloganeering. I am the only candidate that has created and attracted jobs and rebuilt communities. I believe that it is possible to do something as a congressman, and I've suggested this regional marketing agency down in Southside. It is something that you can do in Congress to attract jobs today and not put it off till the future. To beat Virgil, all Democrats must work together. I need your help. I hope I can count on your help and your support. And I'm here to ask for that today because I think we have a chance this time that we haven't had in a very long time to win the 5th Congressional District. Thank you.
I want to tell three stories. In Martinsville, the idea of a new college. They know it's not going to change their economy there. They know it's not going to change the future of low-wage jobs. They know only a few of the children will go to that new college. But they also know that it will be a vote of confidence in a place that hasn't had a vote of confidence in a long time. Circuit City left Martinsville because there weren't enough people to buy TVs. Triple A or a single A baseball team left Martinsville because there weren't enough people to go to baseball games. They want something that they control to bring it in. They need help in Congress to get it done. I was in Brookneal the other day and I saw two gentlemen in a little luncheret, the same one I told you about, the guy who was used to get the fisherman business. And I recognized one of the men and he's on the city council in Brookneal. And he was talking to another man that I didn't know. And I said, well, how you doing, Mr. Adams? And he said, fine. And I said, didn't you have questions about health care issues when I was running last time? And we had communicated after the forum that he and I were together at. And he said, yeah, thanks for responding. He said, that's what we're talking about right now. This is Dr. Drake. He's the only dentist we have in Brookneal. If the Dan River plant closes, he will leave. He will have to close his practice. We will not have a dentist. That makes our community less attractive to anyone else. In fact, Dr. Drake is commuting 4 days a week to Nelson County, Nellie's Ford, to get enough business to keep his food on his plate. So it's an issue of what's happening in these rural areas that really matters. The hollowing out of these counties, the lack of hope. And the last story is I was in church in Danville, an inner city black church, and at the time for the congregation to offer up prayers, four or five mothers prayed for their sons incarcerated in prison. And it was clear that it was having a major impact on that community. I went 120 miles further east to Brunswick. I was in a convenience store, a woman standing there. I introduced myself to her. She works at the local prison, black woman. And so I was talking to her about her job and why she was working in this place, because she didn't make all that much, but she does it. And she said, well, you know, last year they were talking about closing this prison. Praise the Lord, they kept it open. What kind of system have we got where the only hope for black people is to keep people in prison or to go to prison? Thank you.
All right. All right. Bern and Al, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Discussions like this are going to make whoever carries this fight forward to Virgil Goode better, smarter candidate in the fall.
You've been listening to the first debate between Al Weed and Bern Ewert, the two candidates for the Democratic nomination for the 5th Congressional District. It is not yet known exactly how the Democrats will choose their candidate to face Virgil Goode in the fall. If the state party decides to hold a primary in the U.S. Senate race, it is likely that the 5th District candidate will be selected also by primary. If not, it'll be a convention, likely to be held in May. I'm Sean Tubbs, and this is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Please visit us at cvillepodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments, please phone us at 434-566-1217. Thanks a lot for listening.